So good afternoon, everyone. So in this Ancient Bones, I'd like to look at four cases from the Denkaroku, the Book of the Transmission of Light. During the April session, I gave talks on cases 1, 2, and 3 on Shakyamuni Buddha, Mahakashapa, and Ananda. And then I jumped ahead to cases 29, 30, and 31, Bodhidharma, Huiko, and Sangsang. In this retreat, we'll continue with the next two stories from India, and then we'll look at two cases in China. So today is case number 4, Sanavasa, who is Ananda's successor, or Dharma heir. The case reads, and this is Cook's translation, like this. Sanavasa asked Ananda, "What kind of thing is the original, unborn nature of all things?" And Aiken translates it like this. "What is the essential nature of things which is intrinsically not born?" Ananda pointed to a corner of Sanavasa's robe. And again he asked, "What kind of thing is the original nature of the Buddha's awakening?" And Aiken translated it as, "What is the essential nature of the supreme way of all Buddhas?" Ananda then grasped a corner of Sanavasa's robe and pulled it. Sanavasa was greatly awakened. So let me read you the verse, and then we'll continue with the main case or story. Cook translated the verse this way. "Sourceless stream from a 10,000-foot cliff, washing out stones, scattering clouds, gushing forth, brushing away the snow, making the flowers fly wildly, a length of pure white silk beyond the dust." And Aiken's rendering goes like this. "From 10,000-foot crags, waters come of no source. They bubble and broil, scattering clouds, penetrating rocks. Snow flies and flowers scatter at random. One strip of white silk transcends dust and rubble." So before going into the cases, I'd like to read you a little bit of Sanavasa's autobiography and then say a bit about that. You know, these stories are all taken from a book called The Transmission of the Lamp, which is a little bit different than this. It was compiled in the 12th century. And I'll bring that book in on the fourth talk and tell you a little bit about the book. It's a really cool book. A monk went around through all the literature and talked to all the people who were living back in the 12th century in China and sort of mapped out lineage charts, both male lineage charts, but also female lineage charts. So it's a very cool book, very interesting book, and extremely hard to get your hands on. Actually, someone gave it to us when we were in Germany, in Freiburg, remember? And he said, "This book is utterly ununderstandable. Why don't you take it?" And we've since cracked the cover thousands of times, and it's a really beautiful book. So whenever I open it, I thank him and his partner for passing it on to us. So this is what it says about Sanavasa. In India, he was called Sanaka, which here in Japan means natural clothing. Sanavasa was born wearing clothes, and later the clothes became cool in summer and warm in winter. When he aroused the thought of realization and made his home departure, his layman's clothes were spontaneously transformed into monk's clothes, just like an incident recounted concerning the nun lotus color during the Buddha's lifetime. When he was a merchant long ago in previous lifetimes, he presented 100 lengths of woolen cloth to 100 Buddhas. Since then, as a result of his acts, he wore this natural clothing over many lifetimes. Also in India, Sanavasa is the name of a grass called Nine Branch Splendor. When a saintly person is born, This grass grows on pure ground. This grass grew when Sanavasa was born, hence his name. He was born after being carried in the womb for 6 years. The poor woman. In ancient times, plus he had clothes on. I wonder what they do in Texas with that. In ancient times, the world honored one pointed to a lush verdant forest and told Ananda, this grove is called Uramanda, and 100 years after my death, there will be a monk named Sanavasta, and he will turn the wheel of the wondrous Dharma here. So he turned the wheel of the Dharma and vanquished a fire dragon. The dragon submitted to him and presented him with the grove. Truly, this was all in accordance with the world-honored one's prediction. The venerable Sanavasa was originally a wizard who lived in the Himalaya mountains, and he joined with the venerable Ananda, and so we have this story. So I know over the months of talking about this transmission of the light, some of you have been struck, or even simply stuck, on the fanciful lives that our Indian and early Chinese ancestors lived. There are dragons in the tales, utterly amazing birth stories and lives of predictions and forecast that sit uneasily with many of our modern, rational, scientific, secular neuropsychological mindscapes and narratives. Sometimes we think of Zen as filled with form and formality only, with lined shoes and straight back practitioners sitting in black and white attire with regal attitudes and stature. We think of Zen as being straightforward, direct, and immediate, of being bound to the present moment, now, and here. Sometimes we think that Zen is all linear lines, black and white outfits, zabutons and zafus aligned, shoes and clogs arranged straight and narrow, the bells and clappers, the bows and kinhen, all tightly held and presented. But actually Zen has a chthonic past. It comes from the almost dreamlike unconscious depths of humanity, with its wizards and dragons, with its goblins, and with its fear of the night. But then, in this text, we see dragons fly through the Zendo, and wizards stalk them, and predictions and magical births and deaths occur as simply and easily, as naturally, as the sun rising in the east and the moon setting in the west. So how do we hold these two discordant tellings, one of straight lines and the other of wizards and dragons, one almost pre-rational and the other pointing to the post-rational? I think the answer is to sit in the middle and don't be swayed by your own stories and by your own leanings. And let yourself be surprised and startled. Let yourself be surprised and startled by the stories and tales, but also by your own reactions, by your own tendencies, and by your own beliefs in what you think Zen is and what you think Zen should be. We all have stories. Some even say that is what we are. Personally, I think of these Denku Roku stories, these tales, especially of the Indian and early Chinese ones, as early developmental stages in a new course of human evolution. These early tales are young in perspective. Think of our youthful and young adult fairy tales filled with dragons, sleeping maidens, kissed frogs and elves. But as we move through India and further into China, the tale's tellings change significantly in scope and scape. The Jungian psychologist Alan Shinen, in his Once Upon a Midlife, has ferreted out a different developmental group of tales that have shed the goblins, dragons, predictions, and unimaginable births and deaths. And he highlights where these new tales, actually they're old tales, highlight the new goals and tasks of a well-lived midlife, a later developmental stage for us and also for Zen. Shinen has lately continued this telling with tales for an older life from a book called Tales and the Second Half of Life. And he has one other book called Beyond the Hero. All are informative, thought-provoking, and open up another facet to fairy tales as we watch the development and the maturation of humankind and of Zen. So if you become bogged down in Kazon's wonderful storytelling, occasionally jump to the middle or end of the Denkuroku for stories more grounded in things that we can directly relate to, although they aren't necessarily any more true. Find your own way to enter these tales. And if nothing else, imagine this wonderful place from across the globe, across times, with an Avatamsaka Sutra-like landscape, where things unknown or forgotten by us can happen, and let them loosen the associations to your normal and regular thoughts, feelings, and sensations. Let them loosen the associations, and that will be a wonderful starting place to enter this first day of Ancient Bones. So Sanavasa asked Ananda, what is the essential nature of things which is intrinsically not born? Ananda pointed to the corner of Sanavasta's kesa. And again, Sanavasa asked, what is the essential nature of the supreme way of all Buddhas? Ananda tugged at the corner of Sanavasta's kesa. So in the last six tesho on the Denkuroku, I've not strayed too far from the case or the verse. In this talk, I'd like to give you more of a feel for Kazon Jokum's brilliance and insight by commenting on lines from his Taisho from this case. So he wrote, in order to let Sanavasa know that Buddhas respond to calls, and Cleary says Buddhas come out in response to the search for them. So in order to let Sanavasa know that Buddhas respond to calls and appear in accordance with knocking, Ananda showed him by grasping the corner of the robe and tugging it. Ananda was and is a living, sitting right in front of you, Buddha. And so he tugged the robe. Right there, right here, is the basic essence of the original unborn. Shakyamuni too tugged when he twirled the flower, and Mahakashapa tugged when he called Ananda. And each succeeding ancestor has had his or her way of tugging, twirling, or twinkling. This is never apart from the original unborn nature of all things. But Cezanne makes clear in his next statement that knowing this intellectually is not good enough when he says, though none of us may be confused about this matter, still, if we do not experience it for ourselves, we will not realize we are the mothers of the wisdom of all Buddhas. So what a beautiful and penetrating insight. We will not realize that we are the mothers of the wisdom of all Buddhas. Each one of us, in each and every moment, is the mother of the wisdom of all Buddhas. And we have to experience this for ourselves. Thich Nhat Hanh and Akin Roshi, no matter how penetrating their insight, cannot realize this for you. Eileen and I can point, but you have to drink your own cup of tea to know if it is sweet or sour. But fortunately, this path that is being pointed to has been well-worn, and it is well-marked. And I am jumping ahead for a moment in Cezanne's Teisho, but at one point he says, and I am stringing together a few different sentences, he says there may have been differences in the periods of Buddhism in India, China, and Japan, and also the United States, and Canada, and Mexico. Yet there have been plenty of sages who realized the fruits of Buddhism. Since you have the same faculties as the ancients, wherever you go, it can be said that you are this complete person. Your physical and mental elements are no different from those of Sanavasta, Ananda, Kashyapa, or Shakyamuni Buddha. So why would you be different in ability to wake up? As far as the way is concerned, you are already the mother of wisdom. In the past, you planted seeds of virtue and formed an affinity with love, wisdom, and compassion. And it is because of this affinity that you have come here to Mountain Lamp. And it's because you have already planted seeds of virtue, of wisdom, love, and compassion, that you have come here to this Ancient Bones retreat. This very affinity puts you shoulder to shoulder with Sanavasa and Ananda. It puts you knee to knee with Robert Akin and Thich Nhat Hanh and all those who have come before us and with those who will inevitably come after us. If you practice to the best of your ability, are you? What is the best of your ability? No one can tell you that. You have to look inside and know. What is the best of your ability? If you practice to the best of your ability, you will be Buddhas all of your lives. The practice of Zen must be one's own practice of realization. In May, as you know, we studied the last chapter of the Avatamsaka Sutra. This chapter was titled Entry into the Realm of Reality. In it, the young lay practitioner Sudana traveled around the immeasurable and innumerable worlds to visit and learn from the 53 teachers his root teacher Manjushri thought would be best and most helpful for his learning. And actually, as I said in that retreat, we visit that exact number of people as we walk through the Tenku Roku, the book of the transmission of light. So there was a lovely echo in May as we walked with Sudhana through the Avatamsaka lands, and as we were also in another setting talking about the Denku Roku. So it was lovely to have that fairly explicit echo happening. So after Sudhana introduced himself to most of the teachers, he then asked them some variation of this question. He asked, "Noble One, I have set my mind on supreme perfect realization, but I do not know how a realized person is to carry out and learn the practice of realized beings. Please tell me how to perform and learn the practice of realized beings, and how to act and learn so as to arrive at complete understanding." So this is quite a question for a young person to ask. How naked and how vulnerable to say this. It makes explicit what so many of us work so hard to hide and to avoid. It makes explicit that I really don't know. I really don't know where I've come from, and I don't know where I'll be going. Many religions, of course, have stories about our coming and going, but really, when we look through all the words, none of them know. And if we keep this not knowing hidden, if we deny or avoid it, if we overfunction in our lives by staying busy, by consuming, by using alcohol, sex, and shopping, if we overfunction by being super workers on the job or utterly involved in causes, we lose a great opportunity. Not knowing is an opportunity to move into our own vulnerability and into our suffering and into our brokenness, where we would realize that those very things are the direct manifestations of the Buddha mind itself. Our very brokenness points to, or more accurately yet, is an expression and presentation of the unbroken. Each thing, whether we like it or not, whether we believe it or not, whether we realize it or not, is a direct expression of the essential nature of things, which intrinsically is unborn. So here might be another way to say it. Once the teacher Di Zhang asked the young Fei Yan, who was on pilgrimage with a few of his fellow monk buddies, he said, "Where are you going?" The young man replied, "On pilgrimage, wherever my feet take me." Di Zhang said, "What do you expect from pilgrimage?" "I don't know," said Fei Yan. And Di Zhang said, "Not knowing is most intimate." Not knowing is the most intimate way to know yourself and to know others. Not knowing is the most intimate way to know all of yourself, not just the parts we like and not just the parts we show. Not knowing is knowing yourself in the most intimate way. So Sudhana continually said, "Noble One, I have set my mind on supreme, perfect, complete realization. Please help me." how many of us, how many of you would be so naked in stating your deepest desire to another, thus showing what often stays unshown, thus feeling what often stays unfelt, and thus saying what we so often stay silent about. And if we keep one area unsaid, unfelt, or unshown, unfortunately, this place stains and bleeds into other areas until we become lost and unsaid. We become unfelt and unshown to others, but even to our own selves, even when no one else is around, even at night in our own homes, even at 2 a.m. when it's dark. We've so completely forgotten ourselves by staying unsaid, unfelt, and unshown. Over the years, I've noticed folks are hesitant about stating such a desire as Sudhana's, such a yearning to be intimate, which is realization, because they fear it is too egotistical to say such a thing. But underwriting those words, I think, is a feeling of inadequacy or unworthiness, a sense of deficiency, maybe, that has remained unexamined. But you know, just as the stomach secretes pepsin and the brain thoughts, your heart has feelings. We all feel worth, worthless, sufficient, insufficient, adequate, inadequate. No matter what they are, our task here is to see through them. And you do that not by leaning into them, but not by moving away either. You stay upright in the middle. You stay with. You stay with what is right before you, because that very thing, that very feeling, is neither real nor not real. What faces us, what is always before us, is the entranceway to intimacy. What is always right here is the entranceway to realization. Keizan Jokum said, "You may think that Zen Buddhism is just for special people and that you are not fit for it. But such a view is the stupidest of stupid views." He doesn't mince words, does he? "Who among the ancestors was not immortal? Whose personality was not influenced by social and material values? Whose feelings were not swayed by worth or worthless, by sufficient or insufficient, by adequate or inadequate? But once they practiced, they committed to practicing thoroughly." So this is the key: to unabashedly state your desire, to state your yearning. Have some confidence in not knowing and commit to practicing thoroughly. Just those three things, and then the way will take care of the way in its own way. So now I'll just finish up by saying a few words about Jo Kim's verse. The verse reads, "From 10,000 foot crags come waters of no source. They bubble and broil, scattering clouds penetrating rocks. Snow flies and flowers scatter randomly. One strip of white silk transcends dust and rubble. So in reality, the sourceless stream pours forth from a 100,000-foot cliff, which has no finger or handholds. That stream runs through, over, and around each thing. It flows right here, below our feet. And if we listen closely, sometimes we can hear it. Now is someone clearing their throat. Then is a flicker banging on a green metal roof. If we listen closely, then as a late night owl, and then as a morning dove just recently arrived. Sometimes it goes completely quiet, but that then is how we hear it. It is all of you and me, but we are not the all of it. And though it is pure and dustless, it comes to raucous and unsettling sangha meetings. It roams the almost vacant streets of Syria and Iraq, and it is immediately behind the boarded up windows of abandoned tenements. If you look for it or strain to hear it, you won't. But if you allow yourself to take a walk at midnight without a light or map, you will find it is constantly underfoot, tugging, twirling, or twinkling.